Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Tuesday, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that Barry Bonds, Jason Giambi, Gary Sheffield, and Bill Romanowski were among the athletes who'd allegedly received performance-enhancing drugs from the Bay Area Laboratory Cooperative known as BALCO, which is currently under federal investigation for its part in a drug distribution ring. The Chronicle story led to demands that Major League Baseball should clean its house, even to a headline over a column in the sports section of the Boston Globe that apocalyptically proclaimed shadow of doubt over everything. Late last week, Houston Astros second baseman Jeff Kent even went so far as to question whether Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth might have used performance-enhancing drugs. I'm joined now by Dr. Lyle McKaley, currently vice president of the International Federation of Sports Medicine and director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Children's Hospital in Boston. He joins me now from there. Dr. McKaley, welcome to Only a Game.
Nice to be here.
Let's start by providing an answer for Jeff Kent and for those who might need some historical clarification on this matter. Would it have been possible for Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and their contemporaries in the teens, 20s, and 30s to have used performance-enhancing drugs?
There were certain types of drugs that had been used back to the 1890s, but they were not anabolic steroids. And if they were taking them, they were taking some very primitive attempts at reproducing the anabolic effect, such as ground-up testes and stuff like this.
Not, I assume, to any great effect.
I would doubt it very much.
When did we first see steroids in the medicine cabinets of pro athletes looking to enhance their performances rather than just heal injuries?
Well, this became an issue in this country and in the professional football players. And there were some very famous cases in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, where ultimately certain players did admit that they had taken anabolic steroids. Lyle Alzado was a famous case of this in the Cleveland Browns when he developed some tumors and with great remorse admitted that he had taken high doses of anabolic steroids. It got into pro sports from the bodybuilding gyms.
What distinguishes THG and human growth hormone, the substances presently in the news, from the steroids that you have spoken about and the ones the East Germans were using three decades ago or the ones the Chinese swimmers were using in the 90s?
Well, the THG is a so-called designer drug. It was designed to structurally be able to escape detection in the usually urinary testing that's done at the Olympic level and certainly in professional sports. Growth hormone is a much different situation. Growth hormone is a natural hormone that is responsible for a lot of things in the body and has been touted now as a way of avoiding aging and so forth. And it's normally present, so higher levels are somewhat harder to detect. It's a very difficult problem to police.
The dangerous side effects associated with some steroids have been documented. Organ damage, blood pressure problems, depression, violent mood swings, other conditions as well. Does the medical community know enough about THG and enough about human growth hormone to predict the side effects of those substances?
I think THG most probably not, since this is a new hormone, but probably it'll be very similar to any of the other anabolic steroid type hormones. Growth hormone is a different story. There are concerns raised about its ability to induce cancer formation because it stimulates cells at all different levels. Mm-hmm. It can cause change in the body proportions around the face, the gigantism, the increased size of the mandible of the face. And people have had natural growth hormone tumors. And so we are very, very reluctant to recommend it to anyone except in a very strong clinical situation where there's a question of dwarfism or something like this.
Are you a baseball fan, I wonder? And if so, does the current investigation diminish in any way baseball as far as you're concerned?
I am definitely a baseball fan, a Red Sox fan, of course, formerly a Cubs fan.
And, oh, boy, a double-barrel dose. That's a tough one to take.
That's very tough. But I think that perhaps baseball has been a bit late in addressing this problem. They played a bit of the head-in-the-sand type thing when certain other people were hitting 70 home runs and so forth, the questions were raised. But they should have gone into a more systematic way of policing this issue.
inevitably, as the names have surfaced, people have been looking at pictures of the athletes who've been implicated in this scandal and said, oh, yeah, his head seems bigger or whatever it might be. Is it possible to tell by looking at somebody whether they've been abusing these substances?
Well, to some extent, with the anabolic steroids, you'll start to see development of acne. You'll see streaking-type scars around the chest area anteriorly. There's often a rather dramatic increase in body weight and or maybe loss of weight when they go off them. Mm-hmm. The gym people often talk about the fellows coming in who are on anabolic steroids who have sort of an aggressive stance to their whole demeanor.
Of course, an aggressive stance frequently doesn't hurt a pro athlete any, so some of them have it whether they're using steroids or not.
Hard to distinguish.
Dr. Lyle McKaley is Vice President of the International Federation of Sports Medicine and Director of the Division of Sports Medicine at Children's Hospital in Boston. He was also a four-sport athlete at Harvard while a medical student there, so he never slept, I guess. Dr. McKaley, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
On Monday afternoon at Conti Forum in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts, the men's college hockey team that's been number one in the country through most of the winter is going through an end-of-practice drill. One by one, each player breaks in on the goalie. The last player to pot one has to eat a lemon. Even before the lemon has disappeared, BC Hockey's head coach Jerry York is on his way to the showers.
We had a 1:30 flight. I didn't realize it was that tight.
Where you headed?
Minneapolis. He's a real good recruit. We'll watch him play.
It's a commentary on the state of college hockey that even as Jerry York is trying to sharpen his team for a run at next month's national championship, he's recruiting for next year's team. Certainly the success of this year's squad is due in large part to York's having collected players not only from such local motherlodes as the public and private schools in BC's neighborhood, but from the upper Midwest, Washington State, and points more far-flung. York, who played his college hockey at BC in the 60s, says the routine of a coach has changed considerably since then.
When I was playing here at BC, it was just all Greater Boston kids, and Minneapolis was just straight Twin City candidates. But now they're going to Europe, we're going to Europe. Arizona's one of our great players here, David Spina, so it's really become a much wider circle for recruiting.
Among the recruiting tools Coach York can call upon is the record BC players have made for themselves in the National Hockey League. The first page of the BC team's media guide reads, "The road to the Stanley Cup begins in Chestnut Hill," and features photos of six former BC players hoisting the cup. Among the current players impressed by that statistic is defenseman J.D. Forrest.
Yeah, that'd be something awesome. A couple years ago, after we won it our freshman year in Gianta, Brian Gianta, then went to the Devils and wins the Stanley Cup 2 years later. I mean, I don't think it gets much better than that. You NCAA and the next team you play for, you win the Stanley Cup. That'd be tough to describe, that feeling.
J.D. Forrest is one of a number of players Jerry York has brought in from New York State over the years. Goalie Matti Kaltiainen has relocated from a considerably more distant home, Espoo, Finland. Kaltiainen, who has held BC's opponents to an average of well under 2 goals per game this season, says that he'd love to live permanently in Boston and one day play for the Bruins, who drafted him before he came to BC. But playing for Jerry York first meant he could pursue a degree.
I'm human development major and English minor. Sounds kind of funny, but...
Well, you smile when you say it. What have you enjoyed reading as an English major?
Hamlet, just different books. When I came here, English was really hard for me, but so it was kind of funny that I'm an English minor.
It could be argued that during the winter and early spring, especially this winter and early spring, everybody on the BC team, majors and minors, in hockey. Practice, work in the weight room, team meetings, reviewing films of the opposition, and various other hockey-related responsibilities can fill 6 hours a day. This season, the routine has worked spectacularly well for the Eagles. BC has scored twice as often and allowed about half as many goals as their opponents have scored and allowed. A measure of the team's confidence and flair in the defensive end is that through last weekend, BC had banged in 11 shorthanded goals while giving up just 2. Partly because they've been so successful, some of the players, assistant captain J.D. Forrest among them, dread the part of the year when they'll have more time on their hands.
When the hockey season ends, you just don't know what to do with yourself. You have so much empty space to fill up that you're used to being around the rink, practicing, lifting, doing whatever. So it's kind of like, I hate when the season ends because I just love being a part of the everyday life as a hockey player here. So when the season ends, I'm kind of fidgety. I don't really know what to do. I try to find ice, lift and do what I can, but it's not something I look forward to at the end of the year.
The length of this particular hockey year at Boston College is likely to please Forrest. BC assured itself a place in the postseason weeks ago, and there is every reason to believe Forrest and his mates will be among the last teams playing this spring. Some years ago, when the University of New Hampshire team was charging through a season much like the one BC is presently enjoying, UNH head coach Dick Umilli told me that the team was succeeding in part because there were no bad apples among his players. J.D. Forrest says that's true of this year's Boston College team, too.
Yeah, definitely. You could definitely say that about our team. We have some great kids on this team, and that's a perfect quote because when you have people like that on your team, it ruins the chemistry a little bit. There's none of that in this locker room. We got guys that are putting up crazy numbers, and people aren't even looking at it. It's kind of refreshing when you see a lot of people going after personal accolades that this team just really doesn't care about that stuff. The glory is with the team, and that's a nice thing to have.
The Boston College team will be attempting to conclude with an exclamation point its thoroughly glorious regular season tonight against the University of Maine. The Hockey East Conference Tournament begins next Thursday. The NCAA Tournament begins on March 26th, and the National Championship Finals, popularly known as the Frozen Four, will be held in Boston College's backyard at the Fleet Center in Boston on April 8th and 10th. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Remember that C.W. McCall or classic? It was number 4 with a bullet on the Billboard charts back on February 29th, 1976, which before Sunday was the last time Leap Year Day fell on the fifth Sunday of February. February 29th, 1976 was also the day that Dale Webster determined that he would surf every day until Leap Year Day again fell on the fifth Sunday of February, which was last Sunday. Accordingly, Mr. Webster surfed for 10,407 consecutive days. This required him to take only night jobs and to put off vacations and marriage, among other delights. Now Dale Webster needs ear surgery to remove calcium deposits built up by exposure to water, and looking at the sun has scarred his eyes, but he has said, "I'm afraid of not surfing. It's who I am, and to give it up would be really hard." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, The View from Ringside with boxing writer Thomas Hauser. But first, tiny Mount St. Charles Academy in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, boasts 19 alums drafted by NHL teams. Perhaps more impressively, starting next weekend, the varsity hockey squad will try to extend the school's streak of consecutive state championships to 27 and continue the country's longest such run. Martha Biebinger recently caught up with the team and with some nervous fans of Mount St. Charles' state rivals. She has this report.
Mount St. Charles played its last regular season game on home ice at Adelard Arena on February 24th. The team had clinched the regular season title a few days earlier. Before a recent team practice, junior defenseman Craig Brooks points to dozens of red and white championship banners and ponders the defense of his team's state title.
Well, it's always in the back of your head, all the things that coach has done and all the players before us have done. You look at that one wall and all those managers, you know that you're capable of going and doing it again.
Every person on the team want to make their own mark in Mount's history.
Team captain Nick Lum says the team's strict work ethic keeps Mount St. Charles at the top. The man who has been literally drilling that work ethic into his players for 29 years is head coach Bill Belial. Longtime Mount St. Charles fan Lorenzo Canoyer compares Belial to the coach behind the 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey gold medal.
This guy can't lose. If you see the picture, Miracle on Ice, this guy's a copycat of that, believe me, from way back.
Several former players say Belial has softened since the days when he'd make players skate for 60 minutes in the dark after games Coach Belial thought they shouldn't have lost. The coach used to place buckets on the ice for those who couldn't stomach the late-night drills. But the 74-year-old former Army officer says he still doesn't hesitate to pull a player who isn't following specific instructions off the ice for a game or even longer.
You're going to be blah away or take the highway. I have no favorites. All my Olympians and my pros, they all hate me for 4 years. And some of the kids even hate me now. I'm not a friendly coach. I'm a hard-nosed hockey coach.
Belial says his son and assistant coach Dave has taught him to be more flexible. When Bill Belial considers throwing the entire varsity team off the ice and playing the JVs instead, Dave intervenes. Belial the elder coaches what he calls a simple pass-and-shoot game. His demand for perfection has launched the careers of dozens of pro and semi-pro players. This season, there are 113 U.S.-born players in the NHL. A disproportionate 6 are from this Catholic school in Rhode Island with just over 600 high school students. Brian Boucher began this NHL season as a backup goalie with the Phoenix Coyotes. In January, he broke 2 55-year-old records with 5 straight shutouts and 332 minutes without allowing a goal, records many feel will never be broken again. Boucher says his experience with Coach Belial helped make it possible for him to succeed at the NHL level.
People wouldn't believe this, but in my 9th and 10th grade years, I never made varsity. He taught me that it wasn't going to be easy and that I had to work for it. But I learned to hang in there, and even though you don't get success right away, that maybe if you keep working at it, that you will get success eventually.
Boucher still cites his years at Mount as a major source of pride.
Even to this day, I still brag about, the fact that I played at Mount and the players that are in the NHL that played at Mount. I think it's a wonderful story. I mean, to have this many guys in the NHL from one area, I think is unbelievable.
Boucher and other Mount St. Charles alums say there is a softer side Coach Belial only shows away from the rink. When asked what he's most proud of, Belial doesn't mention his dozens of awards or records. He talks about helping young players on and off the ice.
I'd like to be a father to them and then a coach. I had a lot of parents tell me they don't congratulate me for winning the state. It just, Mr. Belial, I just want to congratulate you for changing our son. He's matured. You made a man out of him. So that's my goal.
Back at Adelard Arena, George Egan, the president of the Rhode Island Hockey Coaches Association, says Mount St. Charles is both an inspiring and a daunting presence for the 31 other boys hockey teams in the state, and particularly for Mount's 4 division rivals.
On the positive side, the exposure and the integrity of this program is so wonderful that the kids have benefited from that. But any time that you've got a team that so dominates the sport, very often other teams just sort of give up the ship.
Mount St. Charles rivals will be vying this weekend for the dubious task of trying to knock the Mounties out of the state tournament for the first time in almost 3 decades. Andy Lucier and his daughter Erica were at Mount St. Charles' last season game to cheer rival LaSalle Academy. They say Mount's reign will come to an end someday.
There'll come a day when...
It may not be when I'm here, but
yeah,
maybe.
It's going to happen in the next couple of years. I can see it.
Mount St. Charles begins competition for the team's 27th straight state championship with a 3-game semifinal series on Friday. For Only a Game, I'm Martha Biebinger.
The View from Ringside, Thomas Hauser's 9th book having to do with boxing, is a collection of the stories he wrote in 2002 and 2003 for magazines and a website. As you might guess, the stories concern triumphant fighters and damaged men, long minutes of courage and lives characterized by decline. Thomas Hauser joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Hauser, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
In one of several articles that you've written about boxer Mickey Ward, you report Ward's reaction to the videotape of his first fight with Arturo Gatti in May of 2002. Ward said, quote, "These two guys are nuts." How often do you suppose a boxer responds that way to watching a fight that he's been in?
It's a common refrain among boxers. They'll sit back afterwards and watch the tape of a fight and they'll say, "Gosh, you know, I didn't know I got hit like that." You know, when you're in the ring, you tend to lose sight. And it sounds odd. If somebody's punching you in the head, you'd think you'd be very much aware of it. But sometimes you tend to lose sight of the extremes to which the action is going. And then you sit back afterwards and you watch the tape and you say, you know, how did I endure that? How did I make it through those rounds?
A couple of your articles consist of collections of remarkable things that fighters have said over the years. Some of them are funny, but one that struck me as very sad came from Larry Holmes, who said at one point, "All fighters are prostitutes, all promoters are pimps." I wonder when Mr. Holmes came to that conclusion, if he was still fighting when he came to that conclusion, and if you find some truth in it.
Larry understood very early in his career what the business was about, and he had no choice but to play the game because that was the only route to the big money heavyweight fights. It's a miserable business. Everybody who is in it, who has any decency, will tell you it's a miserable business. Boxing is the red light district of professional sports. And for somebody like Larry Holmes, who makes it to the top, there are enormous benefits. But for every Larry Holmes, there are hundreds and hundreds of club fighters who are terribly exploited, who don't get what they're entitled to financially, and who walk away from the game broke. In a way, the most poignant comment I've ever heard was from a man named Vince Shlomo, who was a club fighter back in the 1950s, and a very courageous club fighter. He went out, he gave his all every time. And he said to me once, "Fighters get such a raw deal, sometimes it makes me mad that I was ever a fighter."
At one point in The View from Ringside, you quote Don King, perhaps the most illustrious of all promoters in boxing. He says, "If I had Sugar Ray Robinson, he'd be the first billionaire fighter." I wonder if it isn't more likely that Robinson would have been broke and King would have been the first billionaire promoter.
Did Don say he would have been the first billionaire fighter or the first billion-dollar fighter? There's a difference because
without a doubt,
my sense is that if Ray Robinson made $1 billion with Don King, he would not have gotten it all. And, you know, Ray was pretty good with a dollar, too. I will say Sugar Ray Robinson had a saying. He used to say that if I can help somebody make a dollar, I want part of that dollar. And so he saw some pretty glorious heights, both ring-wise and financially, when he was boxing, although he lost most of his money as his life went on. Don King is amazing. Don King is one of the most charismatic, smartest, hardest-working people I've ever known in my life. There are also times when he has acted in very amoral fashion, but not Don King is not boxing's problem today. The problems in boxing go far beyond any one promoter or any one state commissioner or any one manager. The problems are systemic. And if somebody comes into boxing and tries to do the right thing the right way, they're set upon by the others that don't want to see the status quo change.
It is particularly interesting, though, the way you regard King in some of the essays in this book. At one point, you refer to him as, quote, "a man of Shakespearean proportions." Of course, Shakespeare created Iago and Shylock, among others. I wonder if those were the characters you had in mind.
Now, Don King is a Shakespearean character. He's an extraordinary man. In many respects, his rise to prominence is as remarkable as Muhammad Ali's. If you think about it, when Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier fought each other the first time, Don King listened to that fight from a prison cell in Marion, Ohio, where he was serving a sentence for manslaughter. 5 years later, when Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier fought each other in Manila, Don King was the promoter of that fight. And he has been on top in professional boxing for 30 years. This sport, no sport has seen anything like him, and it might be that we won't ever again.
Not surprisingly, several of the stories in your book involve Mike Tyson. Do you suppose that with the perspective of time, people who have encouraged Mike Tyson over the past several years by paying to watch him will feel ashamed of themselves?
I don't think the people who are around Mike Tyson and have been for the past few years will feel ashamed of themselves a few years from now, because these are people who feel no shame. And look, Mike Tyson has had some good people around him, too. There have been some very decent people in his life. The basic problem is Mike Tyson. He still hasn't learned the right way to treat people. He still thinks first of Mike Tyson. Ron Borges, the very talented sports writer for the Boston Globe, wrote once, "Nobody needs to feel sorry for Mike Tyson because Mike does a lot of that and enough of that for himself." And I think that's true. at the end of the day, Mike is responsible for his own conduct.
But I was thinking more of the fans, the people who pay the pay-per-view or buy the very expensive tickets to go see the fights that he's in. Won't they at one point realize, my gosh, I was supporting a freak show?
No. The fans buy tickets for a Mike Tyson fight to see him in person or buy the pay-per-view shows because they want the freak show. They want the train wreck. They want the ear bitten off. That's what they want to see. In addition to the explosive violence, people want the show. If Mike Tyson just goes out there and boxes for 10 rounds and wins a decision, a lot of the people who buy that fight are disappointed. There's a reason that Mike Tyson is still the most compelling name in professional boxing. Mike Tyson has reached into the collective consciousness of us all, not necessarily in a positive way, but he's there. He's a phenomenon. And if you think about it, he's the perfect symbol for the greed and violence and excess that has overtaken this country in the past two decades.
The last entry in your book is entitled George Foreman on Character, and it's a delightful essay in which Mr. Foreman comes across as a sensible and happy middle-aged gentleman. How do you feel about his recent decision to step back into the ring in his mid-50s?
George Foreman isn't stepping back into the ring. There was a proviso in that statement. George said that he would step back into the ring if he could reach 225 pounds. Well, there's as much chance of George Foreman reaching 225 pounds as there is of my having an assignation with Sophia Loren. And I might add, I'm a great admirer of Sophia Loren, so it's not that I wouldn't be available. I mean, it's just George isn't going to fight again. George is a 55-year-old man who personally received $105 million when he sold out his equity interest in his grilling machine. So what George is doing, I suspect, is just staying in the limelight. You know, he recently left his position as a commentator for HBO. That was his most visible platform. So this was a way of keeping his name before the public and selling more grilling machines and helping to sell his new line of big man's clothing and his new food products and all the other commercial ventures he's involved in. I like George Foreman. George Foreman might be the greatest public relations expert of all time. I mean, the job he has done in remaking himself and bringing this new image to the public is extraordinary. But I'd be very, very surprised if George Foreman engaged in a real professional fight again.
Mr. Hauser, listening to you talk about some of the flim-flam with George Foreman and the corruption and the very sad stories as well that you have mentioned, I wonder what it is that has kept you writing about boxing, kept you so close to this sport for so many years.
I've been writing about boxing for 20 years now, and there are a number of things that I like about it. But to summarize it in one sentence, some of the best people I've ever met in my life are in boxing. And I guess I'll have to put some semicolons in rather than start new sentences. So maybe give me a paragraph. I'll say some of the best people I've ever met in my life are in boxing. Some of the worst people I've ever met in my life are in boxing. But it's never boring. And if you are a creative artist, it's a wonderful canvas to paint on.
Thomas Hauser's most recent book is a collection of articles entitled The View from Ringside, Inside the Tumultuous World of Boxing, available from Sport Classic Books. Mr. Hauser has written 30 other books, including Muhammad Ali, His Life and Times. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Hauser, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. In the rain,
doing the same old thing. Joe Louis is a two-fist fighter, and he stands 6 feet tall. And his duty comes, he says the heart of his fall in the rain. Oh, my money with him. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. Nothing to eat. Don't let take a chance with me. I will put you up on your feet. Dining rain, he's still fighting. Done his same old thing. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the curious lure of riding a pliable pole over a barely balanced bar. But first, the news of the week with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
A lot of alliteration from anxious anchors placed in powerful posts.
That was a great week for alliteration. The coach and players of the 27-0 St. Joseph's men's basketball team have been asterisked. They apparently must win their conference tournament to claim an undefeated regular season. This seems a little arbitrary and unfair, don't you think?
Well, you can't. They already have an undefeated regular season. The regular season is the regular season, then the playoffs.
Well, not according to the people who are making the ruling. They say that the conference tournament counts.
It's just another reason why these postseason conference tournaments are blights on the landscape and should be eliminated immediately.
Stanford also has a chance to end the regular season undefeated today when Stanford takes on Washington. I hope the selection committee puts the Cardinal and the Hawks in opposite sides of the bracket. Please, please, please.
Well, there's still some loose talk around the people who study such things that Duke, of all people, may wind up with a number one seed somewhere if they win the ACC tournament, which would be enormously silly. Stanford is undefeated. St. Joe's is undefeated. They're number one seeds. Go figure out the other two from there.
Time for the multiple question college basketball exam of the week, Charlie, with the following brain benders provided by former University of Georgia assistant coach Jim Harrick Jr., who also taught, in quotation marks, a coaching principles and strategies of basketball course back in 2001. Are you ready?
I'm ready to go.
Here we go. Question number one, how many halves are there in a college basketball game? One, two, three, or four?
There are four halves in a college basketball game.
Excellent. Here's question two. How many points does a three-point field goal account for in a basketball game? One,
what
two,
are my choices?
Three, or four?
The answer again is four.
You get an A because in Mr. Herrick's
watch
course,
me shoot, coach!
Everybody gets an A.
These remind me of two things. Number one, how many points is a three-pointer worth? Sounds like the consolation question on You Bet Your Life.
Yes.
After you didn't win. And they also remind me of the great James Thurber account of the football player in his class at Ohio State who was asked in preparation of being eligible for the big game what mode of transportation he took to get to Ohio State, and all his fellow students started making train noises.
Train noises, and they still didn't get it. Charlie, if there is no National Hockey League season next year, folks in Chicago may not notice. On Sunday, the Wolves of the AHL minor league hockey outdrew the Blackhawks. Why not just have the Blackhawks and Wolves swap uniforms?
Well,
then the numbers would make sense, right?
The AHL Wolves are 10 games over 500, and the NHL Blackhawks are 15 games below it. The Wolves drew 12,938 fans to Allstate Arena, and the Blackhawks drew 12,177. To the United Center, minor league hockey is kind of a hoot. Those people who have never gone to a minor league game should actually try it sometime. They're very funny. They're very fan-friendly. And the fact that the AHL is able to prosper in a city where there is already an NHL team, and not just an NHL team, but one of the six original NHL teams, is an indication that the NHL has more problems than trying to blow itself up next year.
On Tuesday, the New York Islanders team announced that it would provide free playoff tickets for season ticket holders the next time the Islanders make the postseason. And in a related story, the Brewers are printing free World Series tickets.
Oh, it's worse than that. You don't get your free playoff tickets with the Islanders unless you buy a full season ticket package for the 2004-2005 campaign, which may not happen.
In an attempt to shift the attention of the baseball writers back to actual baseball, Commissioner Bud Selig directed employees of all 30 baseball teams to decline to comment on the Balco case and on performance-enhancing drugs in general. That ought to work.
Yeah, as James Madison said in the debates over the First Amendment, yeah, and monkeys might fly out of my butt. The genie is not only out of the bottle on this one, it's tap dancing down the middle of Main Street. If Bud Selig hasn't noticed it, given all his legal problems back in Milwaukee, it's probably no surprise. People won't talk about it, but people will talk about it, and it will be the story of the season. I mean, Bud may say this all he wants, but as far as I know, his gag rule doesn't apply to things like, oh, U.S. attorneys.
After suffering respiratory problems for some time, Marge Schott, who owned the Cincinnati Reds the last time that team won a World Series, died on Tuesday. She was 75 years old. Mrs. Schott loved dogs and was generous to a lot of charities, and perhaps we should let it go at that.
Well, perhaps, except it's an indication of how when somebody, particularly when somebody of the Caucasian persuasion dies, they are referred to as tough-talking, chain-smoking, and eccentric, and not racist Hitler-loving.
The alleged biggest name on pro football's free agency list, Javon Kearse, has elected to fly with the Eagles next fall. Has there been enough other reshuffling for you to start naming winners and losers among the NFL teams acquiring folks?
Not really. I think this is a very, very, very risky transaction for the Eagles because there is a lot of feeling around the NFL that Javon Kearse, because he is physically smaller than his reputation, is already breaking down at the age of 27 to the point where he might not be worth the money. I think, you know, the movement of an all-pro offensive lineman like Damian Woody away from the Super Bowl champion New England Patriots is as big a transaction.
On Thursday, the University of Colorado announced, quote, sweeping changes, where have I heard that phrase before, to its football recruiting system. Can you help us with a few of the point-by-point, quote, reforms?
Yes.
And perhaps comment upon why these weren't implemented years and years ago?
No more crime. That's the first one. No more crime. Crime is not good.
Illegal acts are
crime out. Is bad. Illegal acts are right out. Yes, there'll be a curfew moving to 11 o'clock from 1 o'clock in the morning, and a coach will actually have to check this time.
Mm-hmm.
The whole list reads like the list of new laws after the revolution in Woody Allen's Bananas about people changing their underwear every day and wearing it on the outside so we can check. Recruits are, for example, prohibited from attending private parties, bars, or strip clubs, or engaging in activities that violate, and now write these three down, team rules, campus policies, or the law.
Just as we said. Suspended Colorado coach Gary Barnett called allegations of rape by his players, quote, an urban legend. Can you clarify this one for me?
He's doing the best he can to try to maintain some sort of public reputation. Some of the quotes are wonderful. This is my favorite little bit of tap dancing. If we have tea for two in the music queue, you can probably set this one to it. What I think's happening is that all the stories that have come out through the years, and I think that probably some of the coaches around the country last year really put coaches in a tough light.
What?
Tea for two. And how much is a three-pointer worth?
I'm sure that you were delighted to learn this week that Pete Rose will be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Yes!
The World Wrestling Entertainment's Hall of Fame. He'll go in because, according to WWE Chairman Vince McMahon, quote, he has a deep, abiding respect for what we do. You don't suppose Pete Rose will decline that honor, do you?
Well, judging by all the available evidence, Pete Rose was a bad enough gambler that he probably bet on various WWE matches during the day. My favorite thing, though, is he's going to be presented for induction by Kane, referred to in the official release as his 300-pound nemesis in the WrestleMania shows. Did you know Pete Rose had a WrestleMania nemesis?
I didn't know that. I wasn't aware.
Did John Dowd know that?
Just one more thing for him to worry about. And finally, Charlie,
woo-hoo!
London bookmakers are offering a prize of £25,000 to any two-legged competitor who can outrun 30 horses over a 22-mile course in the Looney Marathon. What do you suppose the odds are on this one?
We have moved in our references from James Thurber to Woody Allen's Bananas to Monty Python's Upper Class Twit of the Year competition.
There we go.
300 people are going to run in the Looney Marathon, which is celebrating the fifth anniversary of the death of admittedly marginal rock and roll figure, Screaming Lord Sutch.
Charlie Pierce, who sometimes screams, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me at this time each week on Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Woo. Woo. Woo.
Today in Budapest, the world's best track and field athletes will compete in the pole vault, among other sports, at the World Indoor Championships. If you've ever wondered how pole vaulters come to acquire the requisite knowledge of physics and develop the courage for that potentially dangerous sprint toward the pit and the perilous arc over the bar, then you have something in common with Only a Game's Karen Given, who recently found the answers.
She storylines pretty well, didn't she?
She certainly did, with a bar at 15 feet 9 inches, which would be a new American indoor record.
Like she does before nearly every jump at nearly every meet, pole vaulter Stacy Dragila lifts her hands above her head to get the fans clapping at last weekend's National Indoor Track and Field Championships in Boston, Massachusetts. Dragila's a champion at promoting her sport, and it doesn't seem to matter if the crowd is clapping for her or for their own enjoyment.
And it's just not to be. She was closer at it in Fayetteville a couple weeks ago, but she wins her eighth indoor national championship title.
It hasn't been a great year for Dragila, who at the Sydney Olympics became the first gold medalist in the women's event. She once held the U.S. and world records, but she lost both after switching coaches and altering her technique. At a press conference earlier this year in Boston, Dragila tried to explain the difference.
I was used to taking off a little bit under, having a lot of pressure on the pole, and now we're getting my step out, having a more free takeoff, and not having the pressure on the pole, and it's kind of a technical thing.
It's safe to say that at least one journalist in the room was scratching her head over that one. Even without the technical details, pole vaulting is a mystery to many. A vaulter runs toward a pit with a long stick in his hands, plants it in the ground, and somehow uses it to propel himself upside down over a bar as high as 20 feet in the air. It almost seems like, well, I don't really want to say it.
It's not magic. It's science.
Thank goodness Bill Nye the Science Guy is around to explain these things.
Pole vaulting works because a modern fiberglass pole vaulting pole is elastic. It is springy. Maybe not like a rubber band, but like the spring in your ballpoint pen. So you take some of the energy that you would have gained by running full speed toward the pole vaulting pit and store that energy in the big springy fiberglass pole vaulting pole.
Then it's the not-so-simple matter of positioning your body to take advantage of the spring as it uncoils.
It's spectacular. People go straight up feet first. Ah, it's a beautiful part of track and field.
How much do you trust physics here? Would you try it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, are you kidding? It's, you talk about trusting the numbers. Boom, you just wind up that pole, and the pole straightens out and hurls you over the bar. Ah, ah.
Unlike much of the science Bill Nye advocates, don't try this one at home. Between February and April of 2002, three pole vaulters died, and the National Center for Catastrophic Sports Injury Research says pole vaulting is more dangerous than even football, averaging at least one death per year between 1983 and 2000.
Hey, keep the plant, keep the knee up. Be patient for your legs to swing through. Long pendulum.
Todd Elwell, track and field coach for Newton South High School in Massachusetts, is wary of the risks as he supervises a small group of vaulters in the school's brand new field house. Elwell's been coaching the sport for 18 years, but he first gave it a try in college. Even in the intervening years, he hasn't forgotten the feeling.
It's very, very scary to leave Mother Earth and go to orbit. But I believe that I was going to land on the mat, and I also believe that my plant was going to be such that it would allow me to go past vertical. And that was the first thing I was told. You got to keep your speed up, trust your steps. If you can get your steps down, then you know you're going to be in the right place at the right time in order to do the plant.
Your step was good. Same place.
High school sophomore Emma Burrows picked up the sport on a whim a year ago and admits flying through the air on a fiberglass pole felt awkward in the beginning. But convincing her body that this was a good idea might have been easier than convincing her extended family.
I'm glad they're not overprotective, or else I think I wouldn't be allowed to. But like family friends joke, they're like, now you can wear your helmet and your knee pads and all this stuff. But I mean, we've never gotten hurt, so they don't worry that much.
Even in the beginning, did you ever sort of get towards that pit and think, oh, God, do I really want to do this?
Yeah, but that's probably the worst thing to do because you have to be confident or else you're not going to be successful with it. So you can have your worries and doubts before, but as soon as you get there, you have to have the confidence that you're going to get over it, or at least land on the mat and not like in the plant box or something like that.
Anya here did not have enough speed to carry her to vertical, so she landed in the plant box, which is rather embarrassing to be doing 2 weeks before nationals.
Luckily, Anya's competing in the high jump, not the pole vault, and her aborted vault attempt didn't cause any harm. Elwell tries his best to instill a little caution into generally fearless high schoolers. He didn't have that problem with one of his most recent trainees, Newton South's 37-year-old wrestling coach, Adam Rotatori, who first gave pole vaulting a try last Friday afternoon.
It's very nerve-wracking. Like, if you took a smaller pole, went over a brook or something, you wouldn't think twice about it, but because it's big pole and you got the pit there and everything else, and you know that you're going to be up in the air a little bit, I was definitely tentative, probably first five tries. But once you get used to your body flying through the air and that it's going to land on the mats, it kind of puts you at ease.
Most of Elwell's first-timers wait until their fourth or fifth session to attempt a clearance at any height. But after just an afternoon, Rotatori was enough at ease to jump 7 feet, and he's pretty sure he'd like to come back and do it again.
I think that with some practice, I wouldn't be half bad, I don't think, for someone my age anyways. Although I did walk away with a pulled muscle. That was hurting for about 3 days. I didn't want to tell him that, but...
Oh, no.
There's the age thing getting to you, you know?
Rotatori's minor mishap notwithstanding, Elwell's likely to keep showing the sport of pole vaulting to anyone who asks.
I wish everybody had an opportunity to try it because it's supposedly one of the 10 hardest things to do out of all sports and all activities that you would try to teach someone. This is one of the top 10. Initially, I was like, okay, I can't do this. And then once I took the time to break it down, the kids love it because it's kind of like playing. I mean, how many times have we gone and climbed trees or done things where we're playing and we found out about the laws of physics just by virtue of our body flying through the air, hopefully not landing on anything that breaks, but we jumped on our beds from different objects. We've got a big bed out here, so we have room for making mistakes.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Boris Trepachki. We had help this week from Stephen Belter at WRNI in Providence and from Manoli Weatherill at NPR's New York Bureau. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or perhaps learn how to fly via our pole vaulting pictorial. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bill Nye, the science guy.
WBUR, Boston.
Bill Nye, the jingle guy. Don't try that at home. And Bill, hang on to your day job. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.